Hello, I'm Matt Welch, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, and please rate and review us while you are there. The Reason Podcast is where we talk up and chew up and spit out the news of the day and the week with Reason's editorial luminaries. Today, Nick Gillespie calling from the sex-starved capital of the world in Ohio, apparently. Nick, how you doing?
Our Supreme Court justice had sex not just with 50 women, but 50 beautiful women. So
aspirational. And from D.C., we have Catherine Mangue Ward and Peter Suderman. You're both online from D.C., yes?
Indeed, we are.
Glad to be here.
Outstanding. So on Thursday, well, today we're going to be talking about tax reform, Charles Manson, Roy Moore, and we're going to hopefully, Al Franken will hopefully knit them all together in a cohesive whole.
Matt, can we knit them together in a pussy hat for Donald Trump's presidency?
Or a quilt made out of skin? Starting off on a good point, Andrew Heaton normally is sitting in this moderator chair, but from what I understand, he's off out of the country shooting elephants while that is still legal temporarily. So, make sure when you write and review us later at iTunes, you talk about how much better I was than Andrew. We're going to start off with tax reform. And Nick, I'm going to dump it on your head in a second. But just to set it up, on Thursday, the House of Representatives voted 227 to 205. For their version of the big tax reform, tax overhaul, which is probably the only thing that the Republican Congress is going, big thing that the Republican Congress might pass during President Donald Trump's first couple of years here. There were only 13 Republican defections from that bill. And of those, I would say exactly one, Walter Jones, was objecting to it for reasons that maybe the people on this podcast might object to it, which is that it's going to blow up the debt. There's no way that it's not. And so that kind of sets up my question to you, Nick. All of us here have had various rates of skepticism about this bill for that reason. And you had people like Thomas Massie and Justin Amash voting for it. Massie told me last week, basically, hey, look, just because these people didn't vote for all my bills or to cut spending doesn't mean I can't vote for a juicy tax cut. Are we out of touch? Are we the problem, Nick, here? Or are Republicans who we normally agree with just kind of folding like a cheap tent?
Yeah, that's a good question. You always want to take into as a baseline, just that politics is not philosophy. And so you don't expect perfection. I don't like this tax bill for a number of reasons, partly because it does nothing. The idea of talking about tax reform independent of spending is problematic for a bunch of reasons that we've hashed out. But I don't know what I would do if I was in Congress. I do know that, this whatever is happening here is not going to be the final word on anything, because like what we actually need is a conversation that looks at, why are things taxed? How are they taxed? Who is taxed? And there's been no discussion of principle here other than a lot of trust me. On the Sunday programs, people were talking about how, it's not even really about the individual rights. This is about corporate tax reform, which is going to, jumpstart the economy and all of this kind of stuff. And, the time for faith-based tax reform or faith-based policy is over. That died somewhere around 2004 at the very latest, just in the 21st century. So I would actually, I also don't care that, Trump is reportedly, and some of his, Kellyanne Conway was saying this morning, they really want to get a big thing done by the end of the year. Who fucking cares? That's not, his need for a win, whatever that means, it shouldn't make us have 10 years of stupidity or something that's not thought through.
Just a quick follow-up, if this can be done quickly, of course. You and Veronique DeRougie wrote a great piece for Reason Magazine 3-4 years ago called The 19% Solution, which is a way of thinking about both taxation and spending. And I think that there's something to that approach, the mindset behind it, that is relevant to this debate. Can you give us a Reader's Digest version of what that was about and how it might relate to what we're talking about?
Essentially, what that was about was the idea that despite all sorts of different ways of trying to get more income out of people, more revenue for the government, generally speaking, in the, you know, in the past 50 years, it's averaged around 17-18%. The CBO at, and this was actually, I think it was more like 5 years ago or so, but the CBO was predicting that revenue, government revenue from all sources as a percentage of GDP would be about 19% for the foreseeable future. We have been spending, you know, north of 21% for a long time, which helps explain annual deficits, which then compound into a national debt, which is, you know, over 100% of the size of the economy, which has negative effects on economic growth and economic innovation and investment and whatnot, or at least we believe that. And so we were saying, you know, like, here's, you can, the first step would be to bring basic annual spending in line with basic annual revenue of 19%. And we suggested ways of cutting that, which it was basically over a decade, you know, reducing the rate of growth or cutting year over year, you know, until we got to a point where, you know, revenue and expenditures were in sync with one another. And it's actually relatively easy to do. I mean, you've talked a lot about it, Matt, and I know, you know, all of us have. Between, you know, 2000 and the end of the Bush administration, federal spending had gone up by 50% in real terms. That included a lot of defense spending. It included a huge amount of entitlement spending and domestic policy spending. We are still in a binge, and we're putting everything on a credit card, and that's going to come due. And until it, you know, it's going to come due, but even in the meantime, it does not help economic growth. So the idea is that through small, persistent cuts and trims in how we spend money, we can, you know, we could balance the budget, which would be positive, not simply for some kind of accounting fetish, but rather it would actually help instill confidence in the future and in the economy. And that alone would do as much as anything to drive economic growth.
Catherine, this tax reform as passed by the House slashes down corporate rate from 35 to 20. It gets rid of state and local tax deductions with a $10,000 cap, which is mostly related to the mortgage interest deduction. And it also greatly reduces the net amount of mortgage interest rate deduction. These are stuff that Reason's been talking about for years and advocating. So what's your problem, dude?
So my problem is the $1.5 to $2 trillion increase in the debt that we're going to get, as Nick described. But also, these are all versions of these cuts or these loophole closes that are maximize political uncertainty. They've been done to make the books balance. They want to get certain top line results, and then they're just fiddling with all of the other numbers to try and make it work. Things are phasing in, things are phasing out. We're seeing the same thing with the carried interest loopholes, with the capital gains at death stuff. There's a bunch of places where it's as if you, you know, somebody was just at the controls of our tax plan, and they were given an arbitrary goal of making these two numbers, you know, these two sets of numbers balance out. And the fact is that all of these things impact people's long-term decisions. So we've just created a plan that is sort of knowable for the next 5 years or so, but then is going to reshuffle all the loopholes again later, which loses all of the upside of tax cuts. The reason we want tax cuts is because it makes people invest in research and development. It makes people invest in their own retirement savings and stock portfolios. None of that is going to happen if the math behind these, the closing of the loopholes and the cuts, isn't permanent.
Jonah Goldberg of National Review, and obviously a sworn enemy of all of us, came up with a phrase to kind of describe the way that this legislation and similar, you know, fiscal cliffs and milk cliffs tend to be, which is adhocracy, where it's it just depends on the who is running Congress, who is running the White House, and they inflict their damage on a very temporary basis that doesn't allow you to plan, as Catherine was saying. Until the next guy or the next team runs thing. And put it against that light, Suderman, there's a huge, huge thing in the Senate bill, which is not in the House bill, which is a repeal, and correct me where my language is off, of the individual mandate. First of all, sort of describe what that is from their point of view. And then second of all, if I'm not mistaken, over the weekend, there was an indication from the president that maybe he's not going to include that after all, because it'll get in the way of passage. What's going on with that piece?
Right. So you remember that Republicans in Congress spent the first 9 months of this year trying to repeal and replace or maybe just rewrite Obamacare. That did not work out. So that's one of the reasons that they are feeling such pressure right now to pass something, anything big when it comes to tax reform. Part of what they have done with tax reform in the Senate bill, not in the House bill, is to include a major healthcare provision, which is what a lot of people are describing as repeal of the individual mandate. Now, that's not quite technically accurate. What it actually does is it leaves the mandate in place, but sets the tax penalty, because we all remember that the mandate is not a requirement to purchase coverage, but a penalty for people who fail to maintain qualifying coverage, sets that tax penalty down to zero. So kind of effectively repeals it. And what that does, for one thing, is it potentially blows up Obamacare, because the way Obamacare is structured is that that mandate requires people to effectively requires people to buy in by penalizing them for not doing so in order to get enough people into the system to make the pre-existing conditions requirements for insurers work out. The other thing, though, that it does is that repealing the individual mandate this way lowers the deficit, which offsets the budgetary effects of the rest of the tax reform package, in this case by about $340 billion over the next decade. And the reason it does that is that, at least on paper, what the Congressional Budget Office says is that without the mandate in place, about 13 million fewer people will have coverage. And that's mostly Medicaid and Obamacare subsidized coverage. And the government pays for that, kicks in for the subsidies and for Medicaid. And so if they're not paying for that, then they're spending, then the government's spending less money. And so in a lot of ways, the shorthand for this is that the mandate is being repealed in order to pay for corporate tax cuts.
So what happened, at what stage in the Obamacare repeal follies that happened earlier this year? I think they took four good swings at it, four bad swings at it, and failed. Was individual mandate part of all of them, part of just one of them? Where was that in that discussion, and where did it get tripped up?
So in general, the bills got rid of the individual mandate, but several of them replaced it with some alternative mechanism, a surcharge in some cases for people who failed to maintain continuous coverage and then wanted to get back into the system. So a bunch of the GOP bills had a mandate-like idea built into them, though not this specific mandate. And it didn't work this specific way. There was a lot of criticism, people arguing, I think probably correctly, that the replacement mandates wouldn't work very well. I think we already see evidence that the one that exists currently doesn't work very well. The replacement mechanisms would have worked even worse. There's been, in fact, a number of folks who say, though, that this mandate is just on a purely sort of just judging it in terms of the policy scheme that it is trying to enact, not on sort of the merits or the constitutionality, that this mandate is too weak, is that it doesn't bring enough people into the system, which is why signups have been weak for Obamacare, far less than the congressional budget expected, and have made the exchanges unstable since Obamacare's major coverage expansion went online.
Catherine, you've been contemptuous of my emphasis on the state and local tax deductions, pointing out, perhaps with some justification, that since that affects me very strongly, that I'm pretending like it's a problem. Here's kind of maybe an open-ended question centered around that concept. Is it not so? Is the shock therapy of making such a big change on someone's tax bill year over year worth it if it's a good defensible policy on its own? Like if Catherine Maggie Ward is in charge of tax reform or little individual bits of it, would you wave your magic wand and get rid of that whole thing right now overnight?
I wouldn't, because I basically never think things can get bad enough for them to then get better. there's just always going to be a worse backlash than a fix. And, you know, I think like the Paul Ryan of yore before he, you know, fell down the Donald Trump rabbit hole or whatever other Welshian mixed metaphor you want to use there, had the right idea, which was to create a plan that phases in slowly, that everyone just gets used to lock it in as much as you can, given the shitty vagaries of Congress, and then hope for the best. And I, of course, I think there should be tax competition, right? Of course, I think people should not be able to deduct their state and local taxes from their federal taxes. That's crazy. But not least because that's always the part of my tax return that I can't finish. I can never find my tax bill from the previous year to show that I, anyway, so I too have personal motivation here, but it undermines the whole idea of states as laboratories of democracy in this way. Of course, it should be done. To do it immediately in the shock therapy form will only lead to a worse backlash. And this is the same as what I was saying before, that the whole point of any of this is to create an environment where people and businesses do things that are good for economic growth. Like, I do think in the end, the Republican obsession with growth is the right one. They're just executing it so stupidly.
I would also add that Catherine's backlash theory applies to the individual mandate as well, and that if Republicans, you know, that they think that repealing the individual mandate will do all the things they want it to do for tax reform, but also make it possible, it'll set up a better healthcare reform. But what they're doing by leaving the pre-existing conditions rules in place and getting rid of the mandate, they run the risk of blowing up the exchanges, making people upset and leading to a political backlash that will not result in a sort of more market-friendly healthcare system.
Yeah, having said all of that, it's also clear that the Republican Party over the, again, you know, just limiting it to the 17 years of this fucking horrible century, has shown absolutely no ability to do any kind of meaningful legislative change that isn't disastrous, like, you know, TARP or Medicare expansion, things like that. In a way, let me say two cheers for shock therapy on both of these things, because Obamacare is stupid and terrible, and it was a terrible way. If the goal was to get more people coverage in a way that was affordable and practical, and that wouldn't stymie the innovation and new ways of doing things that are actually supportable over the long haul, you know, we got to get rid of Obamacare. And so blowing up the exchanges might be worth, like, I don't care if the Republicans face a backlash. I doubt the Democrats would go back to just, oh yeah, we're just going to have Obamacare and make it even worse, because people don't like the individual mandate, which is a horrible thing to have foisted on people. More specifically about tax reform, this goes to the question of, like, why we needed a conversation about the goals of tax, of tax reform. And first and foremost, tax policy shouldn't be about economic growth. Taxes are the price we pay for government, and we need to keep that front and center. And the fact is that we're not willing to pay for what we demand from the government. I actually think if we had to pay full price for government, we would suddenly find out that we really could get by with a lot less of it, because this stuff, what we're getting is bad. And I do think you have to get to a point where state and local taxes should not be deductible from your federal policy, because there's no reason. We need to get rid of all tax expenditures, saying that healthcare, oh, that's different. That's not like compensation. Grad school tuition is not like, mortgage interest deduction. Oh, that's, we have to have that because the homeowning industry, there's no reason to be giving people deductions for this kind of bullshit, especially when all of the deductions end up helping out wealthy people anyway, if fairness is some kind of issue. I mean, like, it's, you know, we need shock therapy absent an actual national conversation to come together around what makes what tax policy is for and how it should be administered.
Yeah, I think it's really telling that the deduction for employer-sponsored health insurance, which is, in many ways, the original sin of the American health policy system, and sort of the thing that is screwing us up the most, is just not even remotely being discussed as part of this supposed tax reform and simplification. Nobody wants to touch it. And so instead, Republicans are kind of taking this roundabout way of touching the politically unpopular part of Obamacare that they can, where they can get, you know, fake CBO money from in order to pay for the rest of what they want to do.
Nick, respond to the two arguments against your argument that I hear the most. One is the Grover Norquist argument of, hey, look, if you start worrying about balancing budgets and talking too much about a deficit, that just means you're going to raise taxes, not lower them. And that's a problem. And the second one, which is related, which again goes to what Thomas Massey was saying, which is that is the kind of logic that says we need to pay for tax cuts with spending cuts. And that is assuming that the money belongs to government. Yeah. Respond to those in light of
First off, Grover Norquist, has systematically failed to address government spending. And he is still pushing the idea that government spending does not matter. Okay, he was a big supporter of the Kansas, you know, at the state level, and there are reasons not to think that, you know, the rest of the country would act like Kansas, but he was full square behind the idea of cutting taxes in Kansas, which they did do. They did not cut spending, and then they had to massively raise taxes. I don't think Grover Norquist, and I say this, you know, I have a great deal of personal affection for him, and I like him. I do not think he has any credibility anymore on talking about taxes. He also consistently says that the Republican Party is the party of small government, which is only exists in his mind. Under George Bush, government expanded tremendously, and it expanded tremendously through spending. We did get some tax cuts under George Bush, and I understand he wants to be anti-utopian and all of that, but he's wrong. Like, you have to talk about government spending. Milton Friedman and others have said that the true measure of government's influence on the economy and on people's lives, much more importantly, is the amount that they spend, the amount the government spends, because you end up paying for that either in the form of reduced services in the future, higher inflation to get rid of the debt, or increased taxes. So there's that.
I think you basically touched that anyways. And I just wanted to elevate the conversation by saying, Catherine, I think if I'm not mistaken, you recently also criticized Grover Norquist in the pages of the New York Times. So did he take you off his Christmas card list?
I don't know yet. I will let you know. I am actually on his Christmas cards list, I think. So we'll see if one shows up this year. But I think he did it with the best of intentions. Like, I will say that. I think, you know, he looked at the problem of cutting government, which is arguably completely intractable. He looked at the problem of cutting taxes and said, okay, well, you know, let's assume politicians are going to do this stupidly. How can I incentivize them to do it slightly less stupidly? And his idea is less stupid than what the default probably would have been. But we still wind up with this situation. And I do think Grover Norquist is more or less personally responsible, and like, kudos to him for having that kind of influence. But I think he's personally responsible for the sort of tricky math that we're getting around how these cuts come and go. It also has to do with how the bills are scored, of course, but Republicans feel very strongly that they signed these pledges and they want to sort of make good on them, but not in the spirit. They're only making good on them in the letter of the law. And, the broader question of cut spending, cut government, drown it in the bathtub, which has always been a Grover Norquist thing. It's only the first bit.
Yeah, that bathtub is pretty big now, isn't it? That bathtub has gotten 50% fatter while Grover has been talking about it. He's your dad's Oldsmobile. He's fighting a battle.
Who doesn't like a nice big bathtub, though?
I don't know. You know, so we're a nation of William Howard Taft now.
Maybe this is a real problem.
No, but I mean, he's your dad's Oldsmobile. He's fighting battles that needed to be fought in the 80s. And, you know, the territory has changed and the issues have changed. We now have a federal debt or a national debt that's over 100% of the economy. That is what's strangling growth much more so than, trimming and supposedly simplifying individual tax brackets, which is going to be just as complicated as anything else. The corporate tax reform is a good idea, and there's actually broad-based bipartisan consensus for reform on that. Then tackle that, hive that off on some level. But it's like, this is all bullshit. And if you're not looking at people like Jonathan Bydlak, BYDLAK, has an organization. He's trying to be the Grover Norquist of spending in terms of getting people, getting politicians to pledge not to increase spending. That is what's in front of us now, not questions about, you know, tinkering with marginal tax rates.
Speaking of bipartisanship and strangling goats, and before we leave the topic for good of tax reform, Peter, can you ruminate a little bit on kind of the role of sort of reverse bipartisanship, of polarization and its direct impacts on legislation of this variety, or lack thereof, correct me where I'm wrong, on tax debate, Obamacare debate, like big hauls now. Just sort of feels like the 81, 86 Reagan tax reforms were at least semi-bipartisan, and it's one reason why they were able to stick for some a period of time. And that just feels like it's off the table now.
It's totally off the table now. And there's two, I think, really important issues that go along with that. Republicans only pass big bills with Republican votes. Democrats only pass big bills with Democratic votes, as we saw with Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, things like that. And so that means that politically, there's just not a lot of support. These bills don't feel stable in the long run. And that is part of what has hobbled Obamacare, is that, you know, again, kind of tabling all of my many, many objections to that law and the way it works, it's totally possible to imagine that that if something like that were passed in the 1970s or the 1980s, there might have been maybe not a sort of universal support amongst Republicans, but there would have been some, and probably they would have spent a bunch of time in committees looking at small tweaks that would have been bipartisan and sort of would have funneled a bunch of money at it. And maybe that would have been worse, actually. But in terms of policy, but in terms of stability, just the stability of this legislation is imperiled by the fact that it is strictly partisan, and that's true for Republican tax reform, for Republican healthcare efforts, for everything that basically Democrats did while they held all the power in Washington under Obama. But the other thing that this does is it means that thanks to Senate rules, you have to pass everything through the reconciliation system. And the reconciliation system is what allows a party to pass a bill in the Senate with a simple majority. But the reconciliation process has a bunch of weird rules, most notably the Byrd rule, which does not allow any bill to raise the deficit outside of the 10-year window. So that means that this tax bill in the Senate has been constructed basically to score well rather than to be good and to do what we want it to do. So in particular, basically all of the individual rate cuts. So in the Senate bill, that's all, like all the child tax policy stuff, all the stuff that it does to your individual income tax rates, that all expires by 2026, which means that what that means is that the CBO says, oh, those taxes go back up at the end of the decade, and therefore we've got that revenue and it doesn't raise the deficit outside of the decade, except that Republican leadership is running around telling people, just don't worry about that. You know, we're going to get to that cliff and it's going to be fine because Congress, a decade from now, is not going to let those tax cuts expire. Which then, of course, means that this thing actually raises the deficit in the long run. And so what Republicans have done here is kind of set up a gimmick cliff. I mean, the whole thing is just a gimmick designed to score well with the CBO. And so they're not creating policy and making an argument for it being good. They're creating policy and saying, don't worry about what we've actually written into our legislation. We're just doing this in order to score well with the CBO because of the reconciliation process, because everything is strictly partisan. And it's a really, really terrible way to write legislation, to pass laws, and to sort of to come to consensus, to come to any kind of compromise that is going to be, you know, potentially productive and stable over the long run.
I agree. If I can just jump in, you know, in the 86 tax reform, which was bipartisan and which took years to build, like, you know, the tax code is incredibly complicated.
Yeah, that was a 2-year process. Yeah. They're trying to get this thing done in, I mean, it's
in
what,
like,
November
in 30
right now.
Minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. They're trying to get this done before Roy Moore maybe loses the election.
Roy Moore is found, you know, in a chicken factory, you know, rubbing up against eggs or something like that. I mean, this is a real problem, and Obamacare is an example of that too, where You know, when you pass major legislation without any participation from the other party, it is, you know, that's the problem, because whether we like it or not, and this is where I think people like Thomas Massie and Grover Norquist and people who want to be realists, like, you have to understand that, like, you're not going to get what you want, and that building consensus is a long, slow period, especially in an intense period of polarization. And that's what leadership is about. Leadership isn't about strong-arming Ben Nelson into an early retirement, the Democratic senator from Nebraska who cast, you know, the final vote for Obamacare. And then was kicked out of office, you know, basically for doing that, with, you know, plying him with sweeteners and more deals for Nebraska and stuff like that. Leadership is actually forging a bipartisan consensus that's good, and that is not simply about giving people more shit, because we have to remember that under Bush, he was actually pretty bipartisan. Medicare prescription Part D had Democratic votes, you know, the expansion of that, of prescription drugs, of No Child Left Behind, of all his wars, of TARP was a bipartisan enterprise. So bipartisanship is not a good thing in and of itself, but major legislation needs to be bipartisan if it's going to be good and if it is going to be long lasting.
So let's pivot to Roy Moore, since that's a word or a sentence in the English language that we need more of, at least.
Turning always toward Roy Moore.
It's better than the rubbing the chickens and the eggs, if we're being honest about that.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, it's fine. So since the last time we talked, there's been, what, like 7,000 new sex scandals. I will try to narrow our focus a little bit on them. Last week, Thursday, I believe, Al Franken, senator from the great state of Minnesota. There was a piece by Leanne Tweeden, Fox Sports commentator, radio host in L.A., that Al Franken sexually assaulted her. Her story talked about how at a USO performance, he kept trying to basically ram his tongue down her throat as part of a rehearsal for a skit that they did. And then I think probably more lastingly in terms of the public's perception of this, he posed for a Lindy England style photo with his hands kind of honking over where her boobs are. It's unclear whether he's touching them or not. I think he's kind of not, but who knows, on a plane while she's sleeping. It's very creepy. He's smiling. And so this morning, we're talking together on a Monday. Al Franken announced, or his allies announced, that he is not going to be resigning over this, as many Republicans in particular had been calling for, and that they're going to let the Senate ethics investigation play itself out. And this is all in the backdrop of the Roy Moore reporting, which is the sort of the main political event with the groping and all this. And of course, I'm going to go to Catherine first, mostly to give us we're at like week seven of Weinsteinia here. Do you have kind of an architecture of how to sort through all of this? Because I'm seeing right now this has devolved into mostly the kind of if you want Roy Moore to resign, then you should want Al Franken to resign, and you're obviously a hypocrite and the media is obviously biased. What's your kind of architecture of working through the awfulness of this? And do you think Al Franken should resign?
So I just want to say, first of all, I believe that at the end of 2017, the United States is going to look like a Beyonce video. Like, all that's going to be left is like a desert landscape full of like fierce warrior women. And like, all the men will just be gone somewhere hiding, like ashamed in a bunker, except Mike Pence, who will live forever because he doesn't inappropriately interact with women. So just,
but then he's going to have, who's he going to eat with?
He'll have to eat alone.
If it's just women.
Yep, yeah. That's right. Well, his wife might be one of the fierce Beyonce warrior women. I don't know.
I think she is.
So, so first of all, that. Second, I actually feel pretty strongly that, you know, everyone on both sides is utterly blinded by their own partisan desires here. Like, it's a nationwide epidemic of butt Gorsuching, where we're like, well, yes, Roy Moore is literally the worst person in the world, but he'll vote the right way on the things. And yes, Al Franken is also literally the worst person in the world, but he'll vote the right way on the things. And, you know, to pretend that that is not perfectly symmetrical and happening in both parties in an identical manner is to be in denial. So there's that.
Well, hold on. Let me interject there. I haven't seen a lot of apologia for Al Franken here.
Are you kidding me? No,
my Twitter feed is
Twitter is too right wingy then, because like that is happening absolutely everywhere. The idea that...
But like of elected officials too? Because
yeah, well, the idea that we have to give him a break because of this special circumstance or that special circumstance, which, you know, oh, he was a comedian then, so he doesn't have to behave nicely toward women, whatever it is. That's exactly the same thing that you're seeing with Moore saying, you know, well, he had certain beliefs about, you know, how people should find spouses. And he was younger then. I really do think there's there are very direct parallels. Now, I don't think that what they did was the same. And I agree that what we're lacking right now is a mechanism to sort through how we rank the awfulness of all this behavior. At the same time, I'm very encouraged by the fact that at least so far, all of it is happening on the kind of conversational, social, cultural, and commercial level. Are these people going to get fired? Are they going to be condemned? Is the, you know, obviously the party apparatuses of the two major political parties are not quite as private as I would like, but still fundamentally kind of, are we going to stop giving these guys money for their campaigns? And I think that's the right place for it to happen because it's really tricky and every batch of people is going to make their own call on it. There's not a single legal standard, certainly for much of this stuff. It should be below the level of the law.
Matt, I will just read you Democratic Ohio Supreme Court Justice Bill O'Neill, what he wrote on Facebook. I think we referenced this earlier briefly. Now this guy's running for governor of Ohio. Now that the dogs of war are calling for the head of Senator Al Franken, I believe it is time to speak up on behalf of all heterosexual males. Finally, I am so disappointed by this national feeding frenzy about sexual indiscretions decades ago. And then he goes on to brag about having slept with approximately 50 very attractive females himself.
So, Nick, is that work in Ohio? Is that good politics?
Do you vote? Well, I guess you vote for governor, right? But I don't know about Supreme Court justices in Ohio.
He's running for governor. You can vote for this guy if you want. Now,
well, just wait, because Richard Cordray is going to be the white knight who comes in and saves it. Everybody. Matt, the question you asked, and I think Catherine was addressing in a significant way, there's no question that partisanship takes, you know, questions about sexual assault and sexual harassment and makes them even worse. And there's no question that people are willing to say whatever. I mean, the Republicans and Kellyanne Conway this morning essentially said, a Fox advisor that, Roy Moore will be a good vote for tax cuts. He'll be for the agenda. So no, he shouldn't drop out. And that's even assuming he's guilty. That's what people are saying of the events that have been described to him, which are pretty clearly child molestation on some level under Alabama law. He's a sex criminal. If in fact those allegations are true, he questions.
To be clear, though, this was pioneered under Bill Clinton. This was the feminist support for Bill Clinton. It was but he's personally maybe behaving badly, but he will overall be, you know, good for the Jews, right? Good for the women.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, one of the questions here, though, too, is like, you know, there's the question of whether or not guilt has been established or accepted, but then there's also the behavior, and I think with somebody like Al Franken, There's a strong argument to say, you know, this is disgusting behavior. It's bad behavior. It should not be condoned. But should he lose his Senate seat? If this is not part of a much wider pattern and a persistent pattern, I don't think so. I mean, and I don't think it's wrong to say that. When you look at somebody like Brett Ratner, a director and producer in Hollywood, who has been accused of sexual assault, by a number of women, that is very different. Even persistent sexual harassment, whether it's in the workplace and meets the definitions of asking for quid pro quos, if it's persistent, that's a problem. If it's a one-off or something where the situation has been addressed, you know, that's different things. And that's the conversation that I think we're starting to have. And overall, it's a good one. And I think it's one of the things to think about is that this is actually a lagging indicator. Matt, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, we talked a lot about how politics is a lagging indicator of where culture already is. I think what we're seeing here, this is a lagging indicator of the end of the baby boom generation, because it's not neat and generational, but most of the people who are being accused of this are older. They're men. They're older. They've been in power for a long time, and their influence is waning. And what has happened over the past 30 or 40 or 50 years, and certainly over the past 15, is a major shift in what is acceptable behavior in a workplace, or just in general. And that's what this is reflecting. And, you know, my only concern is that there will be people who should not be pilloried, or, you know, there will be some false witches caught up in this, because it is a feeding frenzy at this point. And a lot of these charges are very old. And not that that means, like, you know, if somebody raped somebody, if somebody killed somebody, just because it's 30 years later, you don't be like, oh, okay, you know, whatever. But it is a conversation that is happening, and it's not going to stop. And I think it reflects, it's less driving change. It's more reflecting change that is already taking place and moving into
Given that Al Franken's second apology, or second statement that was a more explicit apology, specifically referenced, you know, doing comedy in the 70s and 80s. I'm going to predict that we're going to hear something about anyone who's involved with Saturday Night Live from the inception. Is maybe not guilty of the Manson murders, but probably has done some
it's not a squeaky clean record, though.
Not a squeaky from record.
See that, right. There we go. Peter, since Gawker is dead, long may it wave. There is not as many. There are not as many publications that are just publishing what journalists are gossiping about in the bar, which was the business model of Gawker, which obviously had a lifespan or a limited lifespan because of it. But you're in DC, you're a Beltway lifer at this point with your oversized dog. Are your journalist pals in the DC cocktail Georgetown circuit, are they all gossiping about who's next?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about the expectation that there will be not just one or two, but a lot of people who are next. And the big national media organizations in particular are devoting an awful lot of reporting effort and time right now to looking for to reporting out stories on Capitol Hill. And so it's not just Al Franken and it's not just Roy Moore. And I don't know, you know, it's too early to talk about names, and but I would expect that we see a number of these stories, possibly of varying quality and severity in terms of the charges, come up in the next several months. You know, the timeline on this is actually pretty striking. It's been maybe 2 months since the initial story about Weinstein came out, and we've already, you know, this has become sort of a really significant national movement. And I think unearthed, you know, a conversation and a lot of stuff that we should be talking about and that shouldn't have happened. At the same time, the speed with which this is moving, I think we should all sort of be at least a little bit, we should be willing to sort of look at critically and sort of understand that moving this fast means that there is a higher likelihood of getting some things wrong and of rushing to judgment where perhaps we shouldn't, perhaps what we need is some kind of judgment, but not the public life death penalty where people are just written out of ever having jobs or any kind of public capacity again.
To be clear, though, I don't think it's at all clear that that most of those sentences are going to stick. I mean, I've already seen plenty of people saying variants at this point, but I think it's true. A year from now, even, you know, half of the men who have fallen in these last 2 months will be rehabilitated, back producing art or words that are part of a journey of redemption or whatever it is. I think public life death penalty is probably an overstatement in nearly all of these cases.
I think we don't know exactly what the punishment should be for what sorts of allegations here. And I think that, you know, it's not obvious, at least to me reading a bunch of these stories, that people have real clarity on what it is that we you know, on what it is that totally crosses the line, what it is that partially crosses a line, what it is that we can basically say, well, that was bad, but we excuse it. And, you know, particularly when it comes to politics, we're just kind of defaulting, as you said, you know, to a sort of purely partisan way of looking at this stuff. And I don't know that there's a better way to do it, though, because you kind of can't have, it's not like you can have, you know, a congressional committee work on this for a couple of years. This has to be done in the court of public opinion through the media and through the public conversation around it. And a lot of that is happening now on social media.
Because this is also something that I think, you know, like I was saying about the sort of private sector adjudicating these claims swiftly, which I totally agree has its downsides. But, you know, getting booted off projects, the, you know, the Gal Gadot saying she's not going to work with her her producer, Brett, who's his face, Ratner, I think that's
Kevin Spacey being like retcon, like his like of a movie.
He was never even in any movies anymore. But I think that's, I mean, while I think we are of course right to say we should be wary of that kind of swift adjudication without, you know, any kind of formal standards of evidence, at the same time, you know, that's, I think this is a case for letting this happen at that level, because otherwise we are talking about, okay, everyone is suspended with pay for the next 2 years. You know, let's look into it forever and ever. Amen. And again, if we're talking about depriving people of their liberty, if we're talking about sending people to jail or, you know, taking their rightly gained property, yeah, I want it to take 2 years, but that's not what we're talking about in these cases. We're talking about continuing, at will and contractual relations with most of these people. And it's legit to break those.
I agree. I'm not sure there's a better way to deal with this. I just do think that it's sort of worth sounding a note of a little bit of caution, just sort of that rushing into this breach here.
I think it'll be.
Are you ready for my caution? Here's to answer Matt's question about is the DC chattering class chattering about who's next? I personally have two steak dinner bets pending right now.
Do you want
on specific dudes?
No.
And I'm not going to name them because I don't want us to rush to judgment,
you know,
here.
There's also a significant difference that's worth thinking about between elected officials who are held to different levels of standards of behavior than private individuals. And so, for instance, let's say, you know, Harvey Weinstein paid off a bunch of people, you know, and that's one thing in a private setting, although it's, you know, it's worth discussing. Elected officials, we know based on recent reporting that, you know, millions of dollars have been paid out over the past 15 years from Congress for sexual harassment settlements. And it may be different if it's a congressman who is persistently harassing somebody in the workplace to a point where they pay off somebody using taxpayer dollars. You know, that should probably get more of a public discussion, you know, than, you know, a similar case. And that's apart from any kind of criminal wrongdoing, you know, because sexual harassment is generally a civil suit. You don't go to jail for that. You go to jail for sexual assault. And that there should be a different standard for public figures, for elected officials, certainly in Congress. And I think the other thing to keep in mind, though, is that this stuff is, you know, needs to be talked about and aired and all of that. But it's also looking at the ways in which the workplace has changed is probably the most important thing for most people. Not to slight the victims, but just in terms of, you know, are offices less, it's good that we're moving out of a Mad Men, you know, sensibility in the office, which I think has happened anyway. But so, you know, there's a lot of different conversations to be having all at the same time.
Elites have also allowed themselves to have the Bud Gorsuch conversation privately for a long time, right? I mean, the Harvey Weinstein, like this revelation that this behavior is essentially built into his contract, you know, all along, important decision makers have been saying, yes, his personal behavior is problematic, but it's worth it because he, you know, in this case, it's not votes the right way. It makes movies that makes millions of dollars. And, you know, in some ways, it's just a democratizing of the conversation that was already being had in kind of a closed door environment.
And it's interesting that in a lot of ways, you know, Hollywood always likes to talk about itself as at the avant-garde of changing mindsets, et cetera. They seem to be bringing up the rear, as does politics, you know, that because most of these conversations took place in more traditional businesses, I think, starting in the 70s, but then very much so in the 80s and 90s. And it's not that everything is perfect everywhere, but in this case, I think, you know, Hollywood has always been given more license because, oh, you know, they're creative people and there's friction, you know, on set and all of that kind of stuff. And if I can say just one more thing, Catherine, when you invoked butt Gorsuching, I actually thought you were making an analogy kind of like butt chugging, and I was absolutely flabbergasted there for a couple of seconds.
But I think you just let us into your own mind, Nick.
Yes, clearly.
I'm not going to say anymore.
Yeah, now please evacuate the entrances. Follow the lighted pathway to an exit.
That's an open world video game that I'm not looking forward to playing.
3 points before we bounce out of here on that, or bounce out of this topic, and I wish I'd used a different word besides bounce. One is that I want to see the names of all those settlements. Obviously, two, I think we can all agree that it's a damn dirty shame that you can't get Louis episodes on HBO anymore. Louis's a good show.
No, it's not.
Louis's good, Nick. And then three, and this is germane to stuff that we talk about, I think, a lot. One of the responses I've seen from the kind of more trolly right, but not necessarily only the trolly right, about Roy Moore in particular is, well, one of the reasons why Alabama voters aren't persuaded by this is because the media has lost all credibility, and so they just don't believe the media. This, to me, is the dead end of kind of partisan-based media criticism. The point of media criticism shouldn't just be that the media is biased, which it is, the media makes mistakes, which it does. It should be towards a heightened sense of literacy about what media does and doesn't do. If you are unable to distinguish between real crap, one source, obviously partisan reporting, and what the Washington Post originally did with its reporting on Roy Moore, or what the New Yorker and the New York Times did in its original reporting from Harvey Weinstein, that's not on the media. That's on you. You have to do a better job of reading and understanding and to be able to assess. And just to say, well, they were wrong about X because Dan Rather didn't understand kerning back in 2004 means that I don't have to pay any attention to this stuff. No, that's dumb. You're sentencing yourself to ignorance, and that's a kind of a pointless exercise. Yes,
Matt, you sound like a stooge of Russian propaganda.
Thank you.
Right now, I mean, I don't know how they got to you, but it sounds like they did.
So, what I'm wondering, Nick, is Harvey Weinstein the Charles Manson of his era? And here's how I'll set that: Charles Manson, who died either last night or this morning, Charles Manson, that crime, the Manson murders, were not only just horrific and became a movie and also made us listen to the White Album differently, but it also kind of was a shock to the system. It was kind of the awful Altamont-style ending of the hippie generation, just became emblematic of a thing that people then recoiled from here. Maybe the Weinstein levels of crimes will be similar to that, or what is your take on the Manson murders, since I haven't read your blog post from this morning, which is for sure excellent?
Well, thank you. But, you know, first I want to point out, Matt, because I think you, me, and the five or six remaining Beatles fans will get a kick out of this. You know, I think Savoy Truffle is actually the most Manson-like song on the White Album, and I think we need to re-examine those lyrics.
It's the is the mean or the clean tangerine?
It's very you know, it depends on how you listen to it. But what I was talking about in terms of the Manson, you know, Charles Manson is dead, and I think mostly the lesson to take away from that is that the baby boom generation, and this does implicate Harvey Weinstein, who talked about growing up in the 60s and 70s when things were different. And that's why he was allowed to rape people, because, you know, we've all seen, you know, Three's Company. It's, you know, anything went. What I'm saying is that the baby boom generation is inescapably and ineluctably moving off stage. Manson was a fixation for baby boomers. And for, you know, and I'm a late baby boomer. I was born in 63. For those of us who grew up in the 70s, still in the afterglow of the counterculture 60s, you know, I watched the Steve Railsback performance in Helter Skelter, a two-part TV movie in 1976, which was pretty stunning. But it's like, you know, it just doesn't matter anymore to most people. And whatever Manson might have allowed us to talk about in certain elements within or certain potentials within the hippie movement and within the breakdown of traditional gatekeeping institutions in the 60s, it just doesn't matter anymore, really, to most people any more than a lot of stuff from the 60s do. And actually, in the post that I wrote today, it's also about like Rolling Stone magazine, which curiously, you know, did a long story on Charles Manson from 1971, I think it was 70 or 71. It's worth reading. It's online. But Rolling Stone magazine was very much, you know, it was birthed, it's celebrating its 50th anniversary. There is a two-part HBO series that is hagiographic about Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone. What it can't get around is the fact that nobody gives a shit about Rolling Stone anymore. It's being sold because it's, you know, it's not working anymore. Jan Wenner is a relic of the past. And I don't mean to completely dismiss or diminish his accomplishments in founding Rolling Stone, but it's like that era has passed. There's a great new critical biography of him called Sticky Fingers, well worth reading, really fascinating if you care about that stuff. But, it, you know, the baby boom is over. It's the downward slope. It is never going to be culturally relevant in the way that it was. The 2016 election, which featured, you know, the three major players, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump, are all ancient baby boomers. Their first wave baby boomers. It's over for that. And I think what we need to do as a society, or those of us with a pulse and those of us who are not looking backwards with nostalgia, as Trump does, as Hillary does, as Bernie Sanders does, to a reimagined past that never existed, you know, let's take this freedom of the end of the baby boom, you know, kind of, you know, overlay on everything. And let's live in the present and look towards the future in ways that are not tainted by these old ideas and these old kind of hobby horses.
What Catherine and Peter couldn't possibly understand is that growing up as a child in the 70s, in part by watching, you know, the weekend movie fair, the D movies played by Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Anytime you see a hippie in the desert, that
Don't
means
stop.
It's going to be it's going to be a satanic death cult forever. I mean, the amount of bravery it took for me to actually become a hippie in the late 80s, given what I knew what was going to happen next in terms of the death.
As the tagline for Race with the Devil, the great Peter Fonda movie from the 70s, if you're going to race with the devil, you better be faster than hell. And now I realize that I'm falling back into, I think that the secret key, the skeleton key to the past 50 years is Riders on the Storm by The Doors, it tells you, a killer on the road. You know, his brain is squirming like a toad. That song has a great shout out to free range parenting, because it insists, even in a world where killers are on the road, and if you pick up this man, sweet family will die, Jim Morrison, the Lizard King, still counsels, let your children play.
Catherine and Peter, rescue us from this generational horror. Since you both share a birthday and are kind of, you're like generation, we don't belong to a generation, since you're both like,
Xennial. We're Xennials.
Millennials. They're millennials.
They're exo-millennials or something like that. Who is your generation's Charles Manson?
Oh, God. I don't know. I fell asleep during that last part of the conversation, so I'm just waking up. But I guess... You know what? Here's the answer.
You know, that's the problem with
Lorena
Bobbitt.
Is the Menendez brothers?
Sleep. You got too much avocado toast.
I think Lorena Bobbitt is, it's more Gen X, but like, I think Lorena Bobbitt is the crazy pants criminal whose crime shaped a generation's sort of imaginings of horror. Lorena Bobbitt. I'm standing by it.
I think that's a good call, but it might not have happened yet. I mean, we're still young. We have a lot of life and a lot of media panics in front of us.
I like that optimism, Suderman. You're like, our Charles Manson is not yet here.
He's in the White House.
Yeah, that's it. It's Donald Trump.
Matt, in the late 90s, it might be Eric Trump, you know, give him time. But now I remember, Matt, and I think you'll appreciate this, that, you know, one of the things that we were put down about, those of us who came in the tail end or, you know, born in the 60s, basically. Oh, it's like we had Charles Manson. You had the Menendez brothers. There was like no utopian sheen laid on.
Oh, but you know what? Actually, I think the other candidate here is O.J. Simpson. In terms of, you know, the sort of crime that captured people's imagination, right? Like, I think before 9/11, where you were when the O.J. Simpson verdict came down was like the thing that you might have fairly guessed was the like point of reminiscence for my generation.
Yeah, they stopped.
I 100% remember it.
How old were you?
Remember in my school, they did not stop school, but there was one kid who had a radio, like an old school radio with one headphone in his ear. And in the middle of biology class, he just real quiet goes, "Not guilty." And then you hear this roar, because I went to a large, mostly black high school. You hear this roar kind of like well up from the bowels of the building. And then kids are just in the hall, like celebrating, throwing paper around and shit. It was like a moment. So maybe O.J. Simpson, who, you know, didn't do it.
But if he did, it would have gone like...
I want to just say...
He's going to find the real killer.
Yeah, but here's how he did it. No, it can't be, because that's 1995. That's like, no, that's too soon for the millennial. It's got to be somebody in the 21st
century. I keep
century.
Freaking telling you, Gillespie, I'm not a millennial. This should prove it.
What year were you born?
1980.
People right. born in 80 so and what 81 are and maybe 82 well, are yeah. generation free. We escaped the generational
trap. Jesus Christ. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You guys, and you're hanging out with Michael York outside of the Logan's
oh,
Run bubble.
Dear.
Yeah.
Just say, God. You cannot,
what a dream.
You cannot define us.
What a dream
with your
that you alone
stereotypes.
Escaped the contingencies of history.
All right, yeah. We've come.
No, you're too special.
I grew up to the Snowflake. End of the internet. Line, you people. And you,
Snowflake, avocado
you
toast.
You all have less than 30 seconds to deliver your closing argument. For why Nick Gillespie should be tried for cultural crimes. If there's any bit of news that you think is important that we haven't discussed or that you're looking at this week, underreported or just of any interest, I'm going to start first with Peter Sudman. Go.
Well, Justice League didn't make $100 million over the weekend. And so a $96 million opening for a movie featuring Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, and The Flash. This is the smallest opening for any DC Universe movie ever. And what it kind of looks like, even though it made $100 million here in the United States, that is a number that basically shows that only the diehards, the people who are going to see literally anything that has Batman in it, showed up. And this movie was heavily re-edited, reworked by Joss Whedon, who came on sort of late in the game, reshot a bunch of stuff over the summer after Zack Snyder left the project due to a family tragedy. And what that basically shows is that one of the biggest projects in Hollywood is collapsing. And they basically were trying to replicate the Marvel model of having a big expanded universe with a whole bunch of different characters who kind of intersected and overlapped. And it's not working. And it's going to be a pretty fascinating test of what happens from here. And if people keep attempting to replicate the Marvel model and make everything an expanded universe, this isn't the first time. This has happened this year. Tom Cruise's Mummy movie was supposed to start a dark universe of old classic Universal movie monsters earlier this summer. And it was another one of these sort of like, well, it made barely enough money, but no one really liked it. It was pretty disastrous. And so it's good. This is the other sea change that I think we're going to see in Hollywood besides Weinstein.
Catherine, can I jump in because I have nothing to say, but I want to add to Peter just that, you know, what we're seeing is the collapse of a baby boomer model of entertainment.
Give it a rest.
You know, the baby boom, baby boom, baby boom. No, but this is, you know what? Aquaman was disciplined not by being dragged out and left in, you know, out of water for an hour. So he's dangerously weak. He was disciplined by the market. The movie sucks.
It is not a good movie.
But all of the people like, you know, Tom Cruise, Brett Ratner, Harvey Weinstein, these are all boomers or near boomers. And the world that they lived in has been evacuated. You know, the structures still stand, but we're moving into a different space. And, you know, it's a better world, even if, you know, for the future of cultural production and consumption to live, the Justice League might die. Eh, you know, I'm willing to live with that.
Catherine, you haven't seen a movie in 7 years. Help us out. What's a good story that we should be paying attention to?
Elephant tusks. This story is so interesting, not least because I think it's something that is a great example of an issue where libertarians and free market types have an ability to kind of overcome the yuck factor to do what is right. I genuinely believe allowing trophy hunting and the legalized import of legally acquired trophies is something that's ultimately good for animal preservation. We have lots of great examples of that. And the fact that Donald Trump's administration moved in the right direction and then Donald Trump got squicked and is going to pull back is a super interesting example of the post-ideological era that we live in. It is a warning to everyone who thinks that Donald Trump's good administrative appointees will rescue us from his bad political instincts. And also, elephant hunting is super badass and done properly is something that we should keep doing because it's badass.
Thank you for reminding us that you're a moral monster. I will add mine is that on Friday was the 28th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. And we should always, every November, thank our lucky stars for one of the great liberatory movements in human history. However, there's also a sadness in that recently in the Czech Republic, which is the successor state, populists won some elections, and there's a lot of kind of grotesque actual, not imagined Russian influence over there, which should concern people much more than whatever phantasm that they're imagining is happening in the United States of America. But that's all the phantasms we have time for here today on the Reason podcast that you've been listening to. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, rate and review us. Talk about how great Matt Welch is instead of Andrew Heaton as a moderator. I'm just like, it's a suggestion. And listen to us again next week. And in fact, every single day, because we have a lot of different podcasts and a lot of great content here. Thank you and goodbye.